I think I've done complained about myself. Sorry. I thought that was great when I said, everyone back on time. Good morning. Today is Wednesday, April 13th, 2011. It is 9:30 a.m. and the city council will come to order. Good morning, Carla.
Good morning.
Did you enjoy the sun?
Yeah. I must have missed it.
You see it on TV. Yeah. Can you please call the roll?
Fish.
Here.
Saltzman.
Here.
Leonard.
Here.
Fritz.
Here.
Adams.
Here. Quorum is present. We shall proceed, beginning with the communications item. Can you please read title for 335?
Request of Belinda D. Jackson to address council regarding IPR exclusion process.
Ms. Jackson. Welcome to the City Council. You just need to give us your first and last name.
Another drill.
Okay.
My name is Belinda Jackson, and I wanted to speak to the council about the IPR exclusion process. The IPR exclusion process is in violation of federal law, due process, and the right to redress government when they have encroached on your rights. The process is such as this. If the IPR deems that you've made too many complaints, they can send you a letter stating, we're no longer going to process your complaints. Unless there is a major incident like guns, or if something happens that is catastrophic, which in its very self is sort of undermining the IPR charter, because you don't want it to get to that point. That's the purpose of having IPR. You recognize behavior that is suspect or that is not in line with the general order, and you correct that behavior, and in correcting that behavior, you're teaching. For IPR to decide that in and of its own self, without an appeals process, that they can select people and say, well, you have made too many complaints. They don't know the circumstance. That could be a law enforcement representative who is targeting this person. And they're only human beings. We have to remember that about law enforcement and employees. They're only human beings. And they sometimes use bad judgment. So they might take something as a slight and think, since they have their law enforcement, they're empowered to do things that they're not. Another thing is they can also say, without any sort of trespass or any sort of law enforcement involvement, IPR can say, you're not allowed to call us, and you're not allowed to come to our building. This is without any law enforcement process whatsoever. And that's in violation of federal law, because basically they've taken their program and they've decided who they're going to allow to participate based on their rules and regulations. When I tried to appeal the process, you can't come to our office. You're not allowed to file a complaint. We're not going to contact you on these complaints. And in order for to file the complaint, you have to, it has to be something disastrous. So if they're going to do that, they have to have an appeals process. And the reason they were allowed to do that is because I was told City Council amended their charter to allow them to target people who they think have filed too many complaints. That's in violation of federal law. I have an email that I sent to the representative, and I will give you a copy of that email.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. Appreciate it. Carla, can you please read the title for item number 336?
336, request of Dahl Williamson to address council regarding student ambassador cooperative project. She called will not be coming.
Okay. Can you please read item number 337?
Request of Charles E. Long to address council regarding Portland's billion-dollar boondoggle.
Mr. Long? All right. We'll now consider the consent agenda. Item number
346.
347 is pulled back to my office. Anything else pulled from the consent agenda? You need to read my title or no?
Pardon?
Do you need to read the title of the item I'm sending back to my office?
346, yes.
Okay.
346, create a new non-represented classification of senior affirmative action diversity analyst and establish a compensation rate for this classification.
Unless there are objections, so ordered. All right, please call the vote on the consent agenda.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Consent agenda is approved. We'll proceed with the 9:30 time certain. Can you please read the title for 338?
Declare intent to initiate local improvement district formation proceedings to construct street, sidewalk, and stormwater improvements from Pardee Street to Leba Street in the Lentz Phase 4 Southeast 118th Avenue Local Improvement District.
Go ahead, Mr. Abbey.
Good morning, Mayor Adams. I'm Andrew Abbey, Local Improvement District Administrator and Project Manager for the Lentz Phase 4 Southeast 118th Avenue LID Project. Joining me today on my left are Roseanne Lee from the Office of Neighborhood Involvement Crime Prevention Section, Dick Haney from Fire and Emergency Services, and Sue Lewis from the Portland Development Commission. Before we get started with the presentation, we have a housekeeping item. We've received additional support for the project, and I've handed out an amendment to Carla and would respectfully request that the council move the amendment to incorporate the additional support for the project.
So moved.
Second.
So moved and seconded. Any discussion? Carla, can you please call the vote on the motion? If you can remember the order, it changes every week.
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Motion is approved. Mr. Abbey?
Thank you, Mayor Adams. If we could switch to the presentation, Carla. So the first slide that you see in front of you is a map of the Lentz Urban Renewal Area, and the dirt and gravel streets and Lentz are color-coded in purple, and the substandard streets, the streets that have paving but don't have curb, drainage, or sidewalks, are shown in purple there. When we, at the inception of the Lentz Urban Renewal Area, Lentz had the second highest proportion of dirt and gravel streets of all the neighborhoods in the city. With PDC's prior investments, that has dropped to number 5, and the residential street paving program has been very successful, and Sue will talk more about that in a moment. Sue, do you want to go ahead and talk about that now in terms of how we selected Southeast 118th and how we got here?
Sure. My name is Sue Lewis. I'm with PDC, and I'm going to provide a little bit of background on the program and how we selected the street. The Lentz Residential Street Improvement Program was established in 2000 after an extensive public process. It establishes criteria on how to select what streets to select first as a priority. And the Citizen Advisory Committee developed this criteria and approved by the commission. It establishes dirt and gravel street as a priority, second substandard streets. And then it goes into proximity to schools, to parks, to public transit stops, to school bus stops, and to major street lines. The program is a 70-30 split, and so what that does is PDC funds 70% of the cost, and the property owners provide 30% of the cost, and that's through the formation of a local improvement district. We do have a part of the program is could provide 100% subsidy should the property owners be 60% MFI, medium family income, or less.
I'm sorry, I missed that last part.
If one of the property owners, there's a grant in the program that if property owners earn 60% or less of medium family income, then they could qualify for 100% subsidy.
I see. Thank you.
And so this particular project has been endorsed by the Lentz Urban Renewal Advisory Committee, and the funds are also allocated in the budget. What we did is we sent letters to all the property owners and residents on dirt and gravel and substandard streets requesting their interest and support in forming an LID because it is one of the crucial parts of the program, because the property owners have to be willing to enter into an LID. And so 118th was selected because it was in the top, scored in the top three. But more importantly, 47% of the property owners on the street expressed interest in supporting an LID, compared to the next level was 14%.
Thank you, Sue. Carla, if we could switch back to the presentation. One thing I wanted to mention to council is that this particular project is located in the Powellhurst-Gilbert Neighborhood Association. The Lentz URA actually has nine neighborhood associations intersecting it. Powellhurst-Gilbert, unfortunately, has more unpaved streets than any other neighborhood association in the city. If you laid them all end-to-end, they would stretch from the Morrison Bridge to Lombard Street, about 5 miles of dirt and gravel street. So we're happy that we're able to select a street from the neighborhood association that is in the most need of help in terms of improving transportation infrastructure. If you look at that map that's in front of you there, that red dashed line shows you the boundary of the Lentz Urban Renewal Area. So while you can see that the needs in Powellhurst-Gilbert are very great, PDC is only able to fund street improvements south of Powell and west of 122nd due to the URA boundary. Moving on to the next slide, this shows you a map of the petition support for the project. We, with the adopted amendments, are up to 91.6% total support for the project. If you factor out the properties owned by the Parks Bureau that are automatically counted in favor, we have 74.1% support for the project. And then if you could take a look at that circle there, that circle shows the existing dead end of Southeast 118th Avenue. And if you keep your eye on that circle, you'll see that there's another dead end at the end of Leba Street, very close by. The distance from one of those dead ends to the other, just to put it in perspective, is very short. It's about two-thirds of the length of City Hall. So if you were walking up Fifth Avenue, two-thirds of the length of City Hall is what the distance is between those two dead ends. And transportation really doesn't like dead-end streets. East Portland has a real issue with connectivity, and you'll hear some more testimony here about why it's important to provide a connection here to connect 118th Avenue to Leba Street. The next slide here is some pictures that we took. The picture on the left shows what it would look like as you approach Raymond Park, and the picture on the right shows what it's like when you leave Raymond Park. Now, one thing about Raymond Park is it's a very unusual park because it has very little abutting parallel frontage serving it. There's just a short segment of 118th south of Raymond, but the park itself is very difficult to access, and unfortunately, one of the three access points, as shown here, is dirt and gravel. And since the park got developed, while the park has been very popular, the property owners have had very limited success in trying to keep the street maintained with the popularity of the park and people going to the park. The timing of this LID is also quite good because transportation has an application in the door for a 9-unit development on Schiller Street. And by doing this LID, we can improve Southeast 118th Avenue all the way to the new development and not take a waiver of remonstrance and then have 9 more homes beating up the street and putting it in even worse shape. So the timing of this LID is quite good.
So can I ask Andrew, about that? Does the developer of that housing have to put in sidewalk and street as part of that development?
Yes.
And shoulder 100% of that cost?
The developer is participating financially in the LID, and in fact, they've signed a petition for the LID. Interesting that you asked that question, Commissioner Leonard, because I think they had thought about actually trying to pave the whole street on their own, because I think they looked at this and thought that their homes wouldn't be very marketable if they had a street looking like what's in front of you going up to serving them. So they are financially participating in the LID, plus they have to widen Schiller Street, put a sidewalk on Schiller Street as well.
So they get the 70% subsidy as well. But typically a developer wouldn't receive that if they were building. They would be required to build the sidewalk in front and not receive any financial assistance.
Right. You're exactly right, Commissioner Leonard. They do receive a subsidy for the 118th frontage, but mm-hmm. I would also note that they don't receive a subsidy for the widening they need to do on Schiller Street. Plus, they have to put in a private street coming off of Schiller Street, and they're not receiving a subsidy for that. So I think it's a very balanced and fair approach. Fair and balanced, maybe that's not the right terminology to use.
Right terminology here.
They're still good words.
So, and then lastly, I just wanted to say that...
We keep trying to stump him, don't we? And it's just...
Lastly, I just wanted to mention that the problem that we have now with the dead-end streets is because there's such insufficient access to the park and there's no parking lot in the park, people tend to park chaotically anywhere they can find a spot on a dirt and gravel street. And I had one woman tell me she actually has to call tow trucks in the summer to get out of her driveway because cars are parked 3, 6, 9 deep at the end of the dead end. She can't get out. So by having a connecting street and making the extension to Leba Street, that'll take care of the parking. Well, it will provide some on-street parking. It won't address all of the needs of parking of the park, but it will most importantly discourage people from blocking the end of the dead end street. And with that, I wanted to go on to the next slide and just mention that this project will not only improve emergency response, but will also improve routine access. Before I turn it over to Dick, I just want to mention that Leba Street is 1,005 feet from 118th Avenue to 122nd Avenue. Southeast 118th Avenue is 865 feet from the dead end up to Holgate. So both of those streets are close to triple the threshold at which fire code regulation would mandate a cul-de-sac or a hammerhead turnaround. And by making this relatively short 130-foot street extension, it has much less impact than if we were to try to put two cul-de-sacs or two hammerheads at the end of the street, to both of those streets, to make them fire code compliant. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dick and then to Roseanne to talk about the connectivity issue.
Good morning. I'm Dick Haney from the Fire Marshal's Office, Assistant Fire Marshal. One of the things I am tasked with is giving advice on projects like this and how they line up to current fire code. And current fire code in the city of Portland is that chimes up here. Current fire code is that dead ends at 300 feet or over get a turnaround of some sort, a 90-foot cul-de-sac or a hammerhead-type turnaround. This is a pre-existing street, but since there's new projects going in that area, that's why I'm brought into it to give advice on that. As Andrew said, Leiby Street is over 1,000 feet long, and it has no turnarounds in that street. 118th, it's a little bit better set up because it does have some cross connectivity from Party and Schiller. So Leiby, I think, is the one that we have the most critical issues with response. Connectivity in the streets, a gridded street system, is actually the most desirable for fire response and emergency response because our equipment, as you well know, is typed as far as what type of jobs they do. So the response, by having a gridded street system, allows the fire responders to come on the radio and talk about who's going in which direction to pick up which hydrants and to get the proper equipment there in the proper order to use. So another issue with the dead-end streets is the fact that if there's no turnaround for fire access, if a wrong address is given, or if it's not uncommon for the 911 to send emergency responders to a glow in the sky in a certain neighborhood, and so it's highly possible that fire rigs could end up going down the wrong street and having to back out all the way, which would be a serious response issue down a 1,000-foot street.
The whole block of wood moves.
I didn't know I had such power. Okay. Good morning, Mayor, Commissioners. My name is Roseanne Lee. I'm with the City of Portland Crime Prevention Program. I am the crime prevention coordinator assigned to Powlers Gilbert. I just want to lend a crime prevention perspective to this project. Southeast 118th, Party to Schiller, and the east side of Raymond Park suffer a lack of what we in crime prevention call territoriality and natural surveillance, especially at that dead end. There's no sense of rhyme or reason as to where you can park or what you can do on that street. So people park anywhere they want, do anything they want. And a lot of times that activity is illegal activity. Reported crime within 1,000 feet of the park for the past 12 months shows a higher than average city rate of stolen cars, car prowls, vandalism, simple and aggravated assaults. There are other crimes too, but they don't quite merit, you know, noting today. Neighborhood anecdotal information, on the other hand, and perception is that there's increasing drug activity and gang presence in the park. And this impression was profoundly reinforced with the May 2009 drive-by shooting death of a young girl attending a party in the northeast end of the park where gang members were present. The shooter's vehicle came in on the southeast 118th entrance, shot from the car into the park, did a U-turn, because you can't drive through, and sped away. Raymond Park, as Ranju and the Fire Bureau said, is pretty much landlocked with only access from that one northeast entrance and the two on the one on Libby and Raymond. And Libby is a dead end. And Raymond, you can actually turn left on, but you can't go north. Let me see. This makes it also an issue for difficulty for Fire Bureau. It's a problem for the Police Bureau in patrolling effectively due to its landlocked nature. Suspects, a lot of them familiar with the area running from a crime on 122nd, head towards the park because they know that the police may be slowed down due to the geographical impediments that they're going to encounter. Gives them that much more time to get into the park, zip through into the bushes, or cross to neighboring side streets. The same issue happens if there's a problem or an address of a location they're responding to. If it turns out to be north or south of where they are, they may have to back or try and do a U-turn on Libby or do a turn and go all the way back out to Holgate and then 122nd and down to another street. So that eats up valuable response time. How will the LID help? It will help by bringing a perception of formality and ownership through the addition of curbs, sidewalks, and designation of where and when people can park. I mean, hopefully maybe there'll be some other amenities, but that's too early yet. It would also provide the ability for police to respond to the park and neighboring area on the east side of Raymond Park by eliminating the dead-end situation at Libby. And there would also be the added opportunity for park users and neighbors to have a better eye on the park. So both of these improvements would help convey a sense of active ownership of the area and discourage the perception that illegal acts may be committed without notice or consequences.
Thank you. And just to wrap up with the last slide, so the way the program is put together, the property owner's share of the LID is capped at 99 cents per square foot, capped and guaranteed by PDC. The average residential assessment for this LID is $5,315, and the largest residential assessment is $26,962. That's for that nine-unit subdivision coming in. I recap the petition support, very strong petition support of 3/4. And then just to recap the project benefits, it improves neighborhood livability, increases access to the park. But council should also be aware that it also supports objectives laid out both in the East Portland Action Plan as well as the Southeast 122nd Avenue study. So I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about the project. Thank you.
So I'm just trying to figure out the actual cost per resident. Based on that, is it? Am I inferring correctly? It's about $17,000 the total cost to install the sidewalks, and then if they pay 30%, that $5,300 is 30% of that.
What we have budgeted right now is not including contingency or overhead. We have about a $750,000 project, and then the LID portion of that altogether is $264,000.
Well, let me tell you why I'm asking the questions I am, and it's not specifically about this project. I think this is actually a great example of a project that at some point in the future the council could use to do this kind of thing citywide. So I've often wondered what it would cost for a person if, absent a URA, you are required as part of an LID to pay your share of the cost. I'm trying to figure out what that cost would be per house if we had such a program citywide that may or may not have funds to help subsidize the installation of sidewalks.
One of the challenges, Commissioner Leonard, is the biggest cost driver is usually the intensity of development. So, for example, one of the things that benefited us here on 118th is we had high-density development, so we had a lot of home sharing in the cost. If you go to Southwest Portland in an R10 zone where people have 100 feet of frontage on one dirt and gravel street and 100 on another, and you've got 200 feet of street to improve, and you've got, you know, one property owner, a couple property owners, makes it a much more expensive proposition than if an area like this where you have fairly high density.
But if I could...
Can you break it down by foot?
Yeah,
so
there you
that
go.
We would be able to say if you have this many feet of frontage, it will cost this much or...
Right, and typically the way our estimates are running right now, typically the cost estimates when you include the contingency, and this is an upfront estimate, it tends to run about $1,500 to $2,000 per centerline foot. So in theory, if you have properties on both sides of the street, which isn't always the case, but it's usually the case, you're looking at an average of $750 to $1,000 a foot, assuming no subsidy. So you can kind of do the math. You know, if you have a 10,000 square foot lot with 100 feet of frontage on two streets, you know, you could be looking at $100,000 just for your share of the LID.
All right. Great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much.
I have a question. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Have we heard from the Neighborhood Association as to whether the Palo Hills Gilbert Neighborhood Association is in support?
I have talked extensively with Mark White, the chair of the Neighborhood Association, and PDC briefed the Palo Hills Gilbert Neighborhood Association back in February. And one thing I neglected to mention is we also did an open house in February and invited, we sent invitations to 715 property owners bounded by 111th on the west, 122nd, Holgate and Herald. So we've done pretty extensive outreach.
But we don't have a formal recommendation from the Neighborhood Association.
Sue, do you want to answer that question?
We do not have a formal letter. If you need one, I'm sure we could get one.
I'm just asking. That's okay. It was just a question. And then the second question I have, sorry, is about there's now going to be a road going through the park, and in fact it's going to take park property to make the connection. I think you made a very compelling case for why this should be. I'm just wondering, is there a Friends of Raymond Park group, and what's the how is the Parks Bureau, Commissioner Fish and others, going to address the increased use of the park that this will enable?
We'd be happy to follow up with you, Commissioner, and give you a briefing on that.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. Anyone wish to testify on 338?
We have one person signed up, Louis Vance.
Mr. Vance.
Right here. That's okay.
Thank you, Mr. Vance. All right. Will you please call the vote on resolution item number 338.
Fritz. I'm sorry. Fish.
I got it.
It's never a dull moment. Andrew, we're spoiled with Andrew's presentations on these issues. They're very complicated, but he presents them in a highly professional and clear way, and we appreciate that. We appreciate everyone who appeared today to describe this process. I thank my colleague, Commissioner Leonard, for his questions, because there's some additional things that he raised, which I think the council can address in the future, and I'm pleased to support the request. Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, I want to thank Andrew and PDC and Crime Prevention Fire Bureau. This is a great LID. I mean, it's great to knock away at that 5 miles of unpaved roads in the Palo Hills Gilbert neighborhood. So I'm really pleased to see this go forward. Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Thank you all for your presentation. This is, it's really excellent to see the focus on streets and sidewalks and on parks as essential parts of an urban renewal district and of a vibrant neighborhood. And the focus on this basic service to provide this street is definitely good use of public money. Aye.
Adams.
Thank you, team, for a great work. Thank you to PDC that helped subsidize what I know would be out of reach for, otherwise be out of the reach for a lot of the property owners along here. I wish the county, when this area was subdivided, required of the developers that which the city has required for over 100 years. But we're chipping away at it, and I'm very grateful for your good work. Aye. 338 is approved. That moves us to time certain resolution item number 339.
Recognize April 2011 as Child Abuse Prevention Month and honor child abuse prevention and intervention programs funded by the Portland Children's Levy.
Commissioner Dan Salzman.
Thank you,
Mayor. To coincide with National Child Abuse Prevention Month, we'd like to acknowledge today the outstanding work being done by Portland's child abuse prevention and intervention programs, specifically those funded by the Portland Children's Levy. Investing in child abuse prevention and intervention programs is a core component of the Children's Levy, which was created by city voters in 2002 and overwhelmingly renewed in 2008. Helping Portland's most vulnerable children and families affected by abuse and neglect is one of our four primary areas, in addition to supporting programs in early childhood, after school and mentoring, and programs to help children in foster care succeed. From 2003 through 2012, the Portland Children's Levy will have invested more than $16.6 million in child abuse prevention and intervention programs. We know that these 19 programs that we invest in promote resiliency, increase stability for families struggling with violence, abuse, and neglect. We know that they help children and parents build healthy and strong connections with social support systems that lead to meaningful and positive changes. And we know that they provide stressed families with support, intervention, respite care, counseling, therapy, and parent education. To tell us more about these levy programs, Lisa Hansel, who oversees these grants, has a short presentation that will be followed by a distinguished panel of providers and experts and some family members who will discuss how these programs are helping Portland families to break the cycle of abuse. So, Lisa Hansel.
Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for taking the time today to recognize Child Abuse Prevention Month and to honor the programs funded through the Child Abuse Prevention portfolio at the Children's Levy. From 2003 through 2012, the levy will have invested $16.6 million, $16.6 million in child abuse prevention and intervention programs. Each year, approximately 2,215 children and their families participate in 19 levy-funded programs. These programs specifically target children and families who may be at greater risk of child abuse or maltreatment, or who have actually been abused or neglected. Programs focus on reducing risk and increasing protective factors that, when present, increase the health and well-being of children and families. Services provided through these programs include parent education, home visiting, intensive case management, counseling, trauma assessment, therapeutic classrooms, and respite care. Speaking of respite care, each year approximately 5,000 hours of respite care are offered as temporary relief to caregivers in stressful situations by providing short-term care for their children. Included in the Child Abuse Prevention and Intervention portfolio are culturally specific programs that serve African and Eastern European immigrant families, as well as programs for Latino and African American children and families. Next, this is a map of the city of Portland, which shows each of the dots represents the administrative offices and the schools where levy-funded programs are occurring. Not included on this map are the over 120 child care providers, or the 36 Head Start sites, or the multitude of home-based services that are provided. The gold dots, which are a little hard to see on the big screen, are specifically the child abuse prevention and intervention programs. If you were to count those dots, you wouldn't count 19 gold dots. And the reason for that is that some of the organizations are funded for more than one child abuse prevention program, as well as the violet or purple dots. Those represent organizations that provide, that are funded for more than one funding area. And so some of the child abuse prevention programs are included there as well. And the final slide that I have for you is the logos for the 14 organizations that provide the 19 child abuse prevention programs through the Children's Levy. So now it's my pleasure to introduce our panel, which is where you'll get a real flavor for the programs and how, and also how this portfolio of programs fits into the larger picture as well. We've invited DHS here today. We have Alicia Hahn and Larry Dalton from the District 2 DHS office. They'll start with an overview of DHS's role in prevention and their focus on keeping children out of foster care, and then also talk a little bit about how the levy-funded programs and general community-funded child abuse prevention programs fit into the picture and their importance in preventing children from entering foster care. We also have Michelle Reynolds, the director of the VOA Relief Nursery, and a parent, Jennifer Clifford, who receives services through the nursery. They'll come up next after Larry and Alicia to talk about the services offered through the nursery. And Gloria Wiggins, division manager for Catholic Charities El Programa Hispano, will discuss services offered through another levy-funded program, the Parent-Child Involvement Project. And Maria will join her, and Maria receives services through the program. So with that, Larry and Alicia.
Thank you.
We are very pleased to be able to testify in support of the Portland Children Levy's child abuse prevention and intervention programs. Oregon has one of the highest rates of foster care in the country. In fact, our foster care rate is about twice the national average, and here in Multnomah County, our foster care rate is even worse. So because of that, the department, both at the state and local levels, has set as one of its highest priorities trying to reduce the rate of foster care that we have. There are two general strategies that you can use to go about in reducing foster care. One of them is to focus on the children that are already in care and try to find permanent homes for them. And by permanent homes, we mean returning the children to their parents or to place them in adoptive or guardianship homes. And to that effort, we are very grateful to the city for its support of Bridge Meadows, which is really going to be helping a lot with helping those children transition from foster care into their permanent homes. So we're very thankful for that. The other strategy for reducing foster care is to try to prevent kids from ever coming into care in the first place. So prevent the need for children to come into the state's involvement. And that is where the Children's Levy's foster care, but child abuse prevention and intervention programs come in. The kinds of services that these providers are providing to the families that are at risk of child abuse and neglect are effectively reducing the number of children that ever come to our attention. So without these programs, we would be seeing more children coming into our care. Another initiative that the department is undertaking is called Differential Response. It's a model that's been used around the country, but is just now coming to Oregon. Typically in child abuse systems, when calls come into the child abuse hotline, there are two paths that can be taken. A hotline screener can either decide that there is reason to believe that child abuse or neglect is occurring, in which case they will make a referral out to the local field office, and a child protective services worker will be assigned to make an assessment. When this occurs, the CPS worker will make a thorough investigation, which will often lead to the child being taken into protective custody and being placed in foster care. The other path that's usually taken with the hotline screener is that they'll decide that abuse and neglect is not occurring, in which case the case will be closed and the family may or may not be referred to a local service provider, and it's up to the family to take part in those services. In the differential response model, there's a third option, and that is for the family, when the screener determines that there is no imminent risk or danger to the child, but the child is at risk of abuse or neglect, the family can be referred to a local community agency for a family assessment. And at this family assessment, it'll be determined what kind of services the family needs in order for those children to remain safely at home. And again, this is where the Children's Levy Child Abuse Prevention Intervention Programs come in. With this model depends entirely on the availability of community resources for the families to be referred to. And without the community resources available to provide the interventions that families need, this system will not work. So again, we are very grateful that the city is supporting the child abuse prevention and intervention programs.
With the governor's focus on prevention and
move the microphone. Oh,
yeah. Can't hear me. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. With the governor's focus on prevention and then also anticipating an 18-month lifetime TANF benefit and the development
of... What kind of benefit?
18 months. They're looking at a family being eligible for TANF for only 18 months lifetime.
What's TANF?
Oh, excuse me. It's temporary assistance for needy families. It's still welfare.
So 18 months, and that's it forever?
That's it. Mm-hmm. And then developing this differential response model, we at the district office took a look at some data about families who were on TANF 2 years ago receiving TANF benefits and the families who currently receive TANF. And 50% of the families who are receiving TANF 2 years ago are continuing to receive those benefits now. We then took a look at some data in one of our Portland DHS offices. And of the families on TANF 2 years ago, approximately 30% of those families entered the child welfare system, and it's actually 40% for Native American families. And the families at risk of entering the child welfare system are not just seen in TANF, in self-sufficiency, but also in our schools, the healthcare systems, the mental health system, our DV network, domestic violence network, and of course the programs funded by the Children's Levy for child abuse prevention. So we started to think about how we could partner and how we were going to really plan for with the families to prevent the crossover into our system. And we just wanted to show you, this is all conceptual. but this is what we're calling a family support network. And it's nothing that, we don't envision this as DHS driven, but really community driven. It's really focused with the family in the center, with a focus on family engagement and hearing the family's voice. And the community would come together to work with the family on different levels and with different combinations of services depending on where the family is in the system. The family support programs, which are on the outside circle, would work to prevent the family from entering the child welfare system. And that circle includes the programs funded by the Children's Levy. And their services to the families are critical in the end result. If the family does enter the child welfare system, we also have family partners, which is the inner circle, which provide intensive hands-on wraparound services to keep families intact and help them navigate the system. Just in closing, the programs funded by the Children's Levy for Foster Care Prevention and Intervention are crucial in working with families and children to prevent their entry into the child welfare and foster care system. DHS works daily with these programs, referring our families that we see who are struggling for their critical services. I want to thank you for funding these programs, and really my hope is that funding would continue.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Just on a personal note, I want to just thank both Alicia Hahn and Larry Dalton for their longtime commitment to our children in this, as working for the Department of Human Services.
We'd like to thank Commissioner Saltzman for his ongoing support.
To remember.
Reuse, that's lovely.
Thank you.
Yes, next we're going to hear from Michelle Reynolds, the Program Director for the Volunteer of America's Family Relief Nursery, and she's bringing up a parent who has successfully used the program, Jennifer Clifford, and your daughter, whose name I forgot. Jayden. What was the name?
Jaden. And Jason, my husband.
Jason. Welcome.
Good morning, and thanks for having us here this morning. I'm the Program Director for Volunteers of America's Family Relief Nursery. We're an intervention and prevention program. And as parents struggle with multiple life challenges, it's often difficult for them to provide consistency, nurturing, and enrichment that help their children grow to be healthy. So our program comes alongside the parents to provide support. We offer therapeutic classrooms with one-on-one attention to the children, developmental assessments. We also provide monthly home visits where we work with the parents to help reduce some of their risk factors. And if we can reduce just two risk factors, it cuts the chance of abuse or neglect in half. And our staff members are helping parents build more healthy lifestyles that provide safety, nurturance, and healthy lifestyles for the children and families. We also have the monthly home visits. We offer transportation services. We have parenting classes as well. And we provide drop-in crisis respite services. And as we celebrate our 19th birthday this week, we are inspired by the changes that our families are making and all the positive things that are happening with the children and parents that we serve. And we're grateful to the Portland Children's Levy for their support and for all the people who are investing in our community. And right now it is my honor to introduce Jennifer Clifford, her daughter Jaden, and her husband Jason, who have been in our program for about a year, and she's going to tell you about her experience with us.
Well, about 3 years ago, I never thought that I was going to be capable of being a parent again.
Jennifer, could you move the microphone or move up closer?
About 3 years ago, I was hopeless. I was stuck in an addiction. I looked like this, horrible. I got blessed with getting into recovery, getting off parole, finally getting a chance to be a mother. Right now, I'm raising Jaden and my son, Dylan, who's 9. When I got introduced to the Relief Nursery, it was like, yeah, I'd been a parent before, but I wasn't successful. The Relief Nursery and Amber, her teacher, have shown me so much to where, I have other kids, but I've never seen them so developed as Jaden is. They help me, like, when I get frustrated, I don't really know what to do. They help me with that. When I moved into my apartment, they gave us a voucher. We were able to go get a bed, household needs that we needed. And it's just, I'm just blessed with them. Jaden, hopefully, you know, most people aren't there as long as I've been there, but I'd like to keep her there as long as possible. And they just have gave me a lot of hope and something that I never thought I'd get back. And now I'm a parent. I'm successful at it. I don't have DHS involved in my life. I'm finally married. I have a license. We have a bank account. And it teaches me how to play with my kids. I never knew before, you know, it's just, I was so young and wanted to do my own thing. And they've just really blessed me. Anything that would help them, I'd vouch for them forever. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for taking the time to come in, and it's so wonderful to see how happy your daughter looks.
Yes, thank you.
Very much. Congratulations.
They even help with Christmas.
That's great. Congratulations on all your success.
Yeah, thank you.
Very great.
And then our final presentation, Gloria Wiggins with El Programa Hispano is going to come up. You're going to bring a parent with you, or?
Yeah. Good morning. I'm Gloria Wiggins with Catholic Charities and Programa Hispano, and I'm here with one of our participants, Maria. She got a little shy with the camera, so she just prefers to stay over there.
Okay.
And she's with her son, David, Kevin.
Hi. Bienvenidos.
Okay. Well, as many of you know, there are several research and studies that show the effects of exposure to domestic violence. The effects of domestic violence in children could be really devastating. Those children could be in the middle of all the whole situation, could be abused, could be neglected. Children could have behavioral issues. They tend to have low performance at school, signs of aggression, and that later could involve violence, gang involvement, addictions, and even become abusers themselves. As an example, we run a gang prevention program with 160 kids, and 90% of them come from homes that experience domestic violence. So there is the myth that children don't know, that they don't understand, that it's between the mother and the father, and the kids, they are so little that probably they don't know what's going on. Well, children know, and domestic violence really affects them. So thanks to the Children's Levy in 2003, we started the Parent-Children Intervention Program that we call PCHIP with our partner Salvation Army and Listen to Kids. This program allows the parent-children specialist, and we have Marta here, she has that role, to meet the clients where they are. She goes to shelters, motels, homes, the Gateway Center, community places, and she works with the clients when they are in crisis. If they just need to leave the domestic violence situation and they need to take care of their safety issues, like restraining orders or those type of things, but they also have a really stressful relationship with the children. So every year we work with over 50 families, mother and kids. Usually that means over 100 children. Typically a mom has two. And they receive different services. They learn how to deal with behavioral issues. They learn how to keep the kids and themselves safe. They learn to deal with the children's feelings, receive or learn how to play with them, how to discipline them, and especially restore that bond that was lost during the domestic violence issue. So I want to read Maria's story. She wrote her presentation, so I have it here. So she has two kids, and she has a while taking the classes for parents in the program PCHIP. She said, I learned since I was pregnant with my son that he was affected by domestic violence. I knew that the baby was suffering and that I was transferring him what I was feeling. It is true that when you reflect on your kids, your feelings and your sadness, and the kids feel the same way that the mother feels. In the PCHIP program, they taught me to recognize that I can't just call the attention of my child and discipline him, especially putting him in a closed room, because when I was in domestic violence, an abuser was with us and kept us in a locked room, the two of us. So I learned that there are other ways to discipline without hurting my child. I also learned to know my feelings. I learned to give a good example to my child, how to ask him for a favor, how to thank him for whatever he did. I also learned how to apply other systems, like help him to develop self-esteem, not to tell him negative ways, but also reinforce the positive, to say, good job, you are smart, you are doing everything well, because those words are good for him and help him to feel safe and develop self-esteem. I can tell that my child had obsessions, that he wanted to control me, and I also learned to give him options. I learned that I shouldn't blackmail my kid, like telling him, if you don't do this, I will buy you that. And I also learned to control my frustration and his frustration. And one of the things is that he now knows how to play with color books or breathe or just count or things like that. I taught him to put his feelings in a little box, and when he's calm, he opens the little box and gets out what he put inside and just put it away. So there are several things that I have learned and has helped me a lot. I want to thank the Children's Levy and Programa for giving me the opportunity to participate in this program, because I have learned many things and I understand that the root of the problem was domestic violence. And thanks to this program, my life has changed, and I'm learning to be a better mother. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Maria. That was very nice. We wish you success.
Congratulations.
So that completes the presentation. I did want to actually just read the names of the 15 organizations. You saw their logos, but I just would like to read them as a way of thanking them for the great work they're doing. So the organizations that provide child abuse prevention intervention services that are in part funded by the Children's Levy include CARES Northwest, Catholic Charities, who we just heard from, the Children's Justice Alliance, the Children's Relief Nursery, Janus Youth Programs, LifeWorks Northwest, Listen to Kids, Lutheran Community Services, Morrison Child and Family Services, Neighborhood House, Portland State University, Salvation Army West Women and Children's Shelter, Self-Enhancement, Inc., and Volunteers of America, the Children's Relief Nursery we just heard. So thank you. That completes the presentation.
Thank you. Is it a resolution? All right.
Yes, it is a resolution.
Does anyone else wish to testify on item number 339?
No one else.
Signed Carla, up. Would you please call the vote on 339?
Fish.
I attended the annual meeting yesterday of the Volunteers of America, and I was joined by County Commissioner Smith, and we are so fortunate to have organizations like Volunteers of America and the honor roll of nonprofits in our community that Dan just read working in this very difficult field. And thank you, Dan, for your leadership, both bringing the Portland Children Levy forward and leading it these many years. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, again, thanks to all the organizations that are doing a great job and to the Portland Children's Levy staff for making sure we get the maximum for our tax dollar in service to our kids. Aye.
Leonard.
I've worked with many of these organizations, particularly when I was in the legislature, on issues dealing with child abuse and family dysfunction, but none so closely as CARES Northwest. This is an organization that deals with the most traumatized children and families that can be. And because of the nature of their work, they can't often talk about what it is that they do, which is unfortunate. So they are constantly underfunded. So this year, as my colleagues are aware, I've asked for a $100,000 one-time grant to CARES Northwest, and I don't usually ask for very much money in one-time requests, but this is one that I feel pretty strongly about, and I hope the council considers carefully to support. But having said that, all of these are outstanding organizations. I appreciate Commissioner Saltzman's ongoing work in dealing with some of the most tragic circumstances that people and families find themselves in our community. Aye.
Fritz.
Thank you, Commissioner Saltzman, for your ongoing leadership on this and for bringing this report to us. I think one of the most compelling things I heard this morning was that 30% of families on temporary assistance will subsequently get into challenges with child abuse. And it's really stressful to have not enough money to put food on the table and keep the roof over the head, and then with children at the same time. That's a very difficult job, too. So we are investing in children. The taxpayers of Portland are investing in children, and we thank them for the services that are being provided, which help families negotiate these tough times and continue to raise their children to go to school and graduate and get good jobs. So it all works together, and thanks to Commissioner Saltzman for leading on this part of it. Aye.
Adams.
Thank you, Commissioner Saltzman. Thanks to all the nonprofit and private sector partners. Great work. Aye. So approved. We have a 3-minute break until our 10:30 time certain. I think it's that time of year.
Yeah.
And we still have to get through the budget, too. All right, it is still Wednesday, April 13th, 2011. We are still in morning session of the Portland City Council. We had a short recess. We will now proceed to the 10:30 time certain agenda item number 340. Carla, would you please read the title?
Mm-hmm. Accept the Portland Bicycle Plan for 2030 1-year progress report.
All right, I am pleased to present the plan for the Portland Bicycle plan, excuse me, present the report for the Portland Bicycle Plan 2030. It will show we have done a lot of work. In fact, I think between what we've done in the last year and what is funded and just ready to implement in the year ahead, this marks, I think, a high watermark for our efforts to provide Portlanders safe access to the corridors that not only benefits bicyclists and benefits pedestrians, but